history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we make that quest, as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our veterans. And you know, usually we're talking to members of the World War II generation. Recently, I told you about an event coming up on April 28th to give Vietnam veterans the welcome home they never got. And the Korean War veterans are saying, what about us? The forgotten war is forgotten again, but not today. We're talking to a Korean War veteran in Albuquerque, New Mexico, John Smetana, 87 years old. Been in Albuquerque a long time, but you grew up in Gary, Indiana, more than a line in a musical, huh?
Correct. Very much so. The Michael Jackson Five, yeah. They're from Gary, Indiana.
Well, and what was your childhood like growing up in Gary, Indiana? Were you dreaming of being a pro ball player or something?
Yeah, well, I figured I could be, I was pretty good. I figured I'd like to go ahead and do that, of course, and growing up, but I wanted to play ball, so I had to come to Albuquerque because my parents were thinking about building or buying a trailer park, and this was 1946, and here you had to have a eligibility of 1 year living here before you could play sports. So I came out early with my oldest brother who was in the Air Force, and he was stationed at Kirtland Air Force Base. And I lived with his wife's parents so I could play ball in high school, which I played basketball, football, and baseball.
Well, and I'm sure before that, when you were still in Gary, you had to have a favorite ball player, right? There had to be someone in the major leagues or a football or basketball star who you looked up to and wanted to emulate.
Joe Cool for the Chicago White Sox played first base. I like that myself. I use a junk pitcher. I'm left-handed. I was a junk pitcher, and I like to throw that way. Very fortunately, I got to see quite a few good guys. Luke Appling, Tony Cuccinello, Cass Michaels, Joe Cool, Taffy Wright. Those are all White Sox guys. Jimmy Dykes was the manager. And an interesting story, Orville Grove, one of the guys on the team, was shot in the foot dove hunting. And my dad knew him. So I got to go down to the dugout at Kaminsky Park, meet all the White Sox, and boy, that was a real dream. So from that time on, I want to try to make the pros.
Well, and there's something else that was happening during those years, and I'm used to talking about it because I spent a lot of time with World War II vets. You weren't in the service yet, but you lived through that time. For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, even for a teenager who wasn't old enough to serve, how big of a jolt or a life changer were those years?
That was very interesting because my oldest brother was in the Air Force, and Pearl Harbor in 1941, I was in junior high. I'll never forget Mrs. Griffith, our history teacher, used to bring the paper every day and read to us about what was going on in the Pacific and all the different battles. And I used to read about the corpsman and the guy from Iwo Jima when they were raising the flag. One of the guys was a corpsman, and in my work as I was growing up, they told me in the Marines, well, you could be a corpsman because of your background. So that was my MOS, which is the title they give to your job. And so that was my introduction to the war.
Yeah, so World War II is over. You move up to Albuquerque here. You're playing sports, probably thinking maybe you will get a shot at pro ball someday. But then the Korean War comes along. You heard you were going to get drafted?
Yeah, I heard we were going to get drafted from a friend of mine down at the draft office. So a bunch of us figured, well, let's join up. Well, I joined the Navy, wanted to go see the world. And I happened to be working in a mortuary at the time while I was going to school. The guy down at the Marine Corps office said, oh, boy, you'd make a good medic. I said, really? He said, yeah, you're used to bodies and hurt people and stuff and taking care of them. I said, yeah, I guess so. And I let it go at that. Well, after boot camp, they had it on my record. And sure enough, they sent us to Bainbridge, Maryland, to the Corps School. And that was interesting. That was after my first 2 years in the Navy. And that's where I learned my medical background as a combat corpsman.
And did you know what you were getting into?
Not at the time, until they said a whole bunch of my friends and I, there was 53 of us, they said, well, you're going to go to Korea. So Korea, over there, that police action that's going on, we didn't know much about it at all. And they said, yeah, well, they needed us bad. So they flew us. Most of the time you went with your company on the ship. Well, but they needed us badly. So they flew us over. We went to Hawaii, Guam, and Kyoto, Japan, where we got all our gear. Then they flew us into Korea above Seoul. From that time on, that's where we were, all 53 of us. And they spread us out all over the country, all with different units in the Marine Corps. And I happened to be with the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, 1st Marine Division.
Yeah, and you spent almost 2 years over there, and we're going to hear some of those stories. But something you said struck me there, because you said you weren't really sure what was going on over in Korea, this little police action. And today, well, North Korea has been in the news a little bit recently with Trump talking to Kim Jong-un and all that. But most people today don't know what the Korean War was all about and what happened there. Do you ever run into people who say, what was the Korean War?
People don't even realize or remember it. It's amazing what they don't know about it. And when I went there in 1951 and 52, 53 in January, there was only one building that was 3 floors high, and that was one of our first command posts that we went to, and that was right outside of Seoul. And now it's like a metropolis, these tremendous big buildings and stuff. And now with North Korea talking about how they are, I hope that the president, Mr. Trump, can get together with Un and talk things over, because I think that would be a big stride toward peace. We need it.
Well, and North Korean civilians could sure use it, because they've had a real dreadful existence for many decades here. South Korea's flourished because of your guys' sacrifice and what you did all those years ago. But I'm sure there had to be a moment for you getting over there that was the welcome to the war zone moment. What was that?
I'm glad you asked that, because when we got there, they put us on a train, and we went up north of Seoul, and then we transferred to trucks, and they motorized us up to the front line. The main line of resistance was the 38th parallel, a little bit north of it. And it was amazing that when I did get there in the morning and woke up, and I asked the sergeant after we got out, I said, well, where is this front line? Where is this MLR? He said, you just look right up that valley in front of you about 75 yards away. He said, that's it right there. He said, so you're in Korea right now. And I was very shocked, along with all the other guys. And just to put the two things in there about the people, the North Koreans at that time, they're pretty nice. You could talk to them and everything else. But the Chinese were the rougher ones, we always felt, at their armor and stuff that they used.
Can you paint a picture of the kind of scenarios you were faced with? How close you were to the artillery that's flying around, the bullets that were flying, grenades, bombs, all of those things? I mean, it sounds like you were right there in the middle of all of it.
How about 500 yards? Imagine 3 or 4 football fields, and we had a command post. When I first got there and started meeting people and some of the officers, we had what they called a command post. And that's where I set up my little medical department. And sure enough, while I was sitting there, only 3 days there, we get shelled by mortars very heavily and got 4 guys killed right in front of me. And a couple guys with a broken back, which we tied up with military cable, electronic cable, and made them a bed and wrapped them up in that and got them out to the helicopters. And I thought, well, this is war. And actually, this is police action, according to back home. And there I was, and I said, well, we're right here, right out in front of us, they're all there. And you could see their trench lines just as easy as ours, and that's how it all started.
Most of us haven't been in a situation like that. You had never been in a situation like that. Is there anything that can prepare you for that? Is there anything that keeps you from being paralyzed with fear and worry that you're not going to make it home and see your family ever again?
You always think of that, and the Marines were great. They took care of me really well. I had a lot of friends and learned my job well, and over there we could get to use it very well. I'll tell you the truth, you're a little bit scared, but you learn what you're doing, and your Marine Corps buddies help you out. And we had great officers, and they wouldn't put you in harm's way. And we used to go on a lot of patrols because there's only three corpsmen per platoon, which was quite a few guys. And so we'd have like 20, 30 guys to take care of. You spend 5 days on a line, and you go back for a rest, and go back for 5 days on a line, and go back for another rest. But as corpsmen, we did a lot of patrols at night. And if the Marine Corps took 9 people out, a corpsman was always with them. So we did the same thing as the Marines did and looked after each other. And I had a few experiences out there, a few wounded, got them back to the lines. Thank goodness they made it. And yeah, it was a different experience. It sure was.
And when you say that you guys as corpsmen did the same thing the Marines did, what you're saying is your life was in every bit as much danger as theirs were.
That's exactly right. I carried an M30, the little carbine, had a .45 caliber pistol, wore that on my hip. But I was strong enough and big enough, I didn't have to carry a stretcher. And when we go on patrol, I felt just like one of the Marines, because if you got attacked or if they did a surprise on you, you'd better be ready to fight them. And we were ready just as they were. And we got along very well. And they really protected corpsmen. The medics to them were life. And so they really took care of us. They knew where we were all the time. And they're a good bunch of guys.
And maybe this is hard to quantify if you spent almost 2 years there, but how frequent was that occurrence of you actually having to treat someone who was wounded, of try to patch him up, try to make sure he doesn't lose his life?
The question like that would be when we were on an outpost, because that's where they really got hit. And when we were on Outpost Vegas, they hit us with everything they had for like 2 full days. And then they came in for hand-to-hand combat. And they are a bunch of wild people. And I said before, the Chinese were actually more wild than the North Koreans. Yeah, you didn't know what to expect. They came up in waves. Some guys didn't even have guns. They'd pick them up when their buddies got shot, screaming, bugles, all that kind of stuff. You hear about it. And that's the way it was. So the outpost is where you got hit a lot. When you were on patrol, you were one-on-one. You didn't really stir trouble. But on an outpost, when you're out there protecting your area and they start bombing you with mortars and big artillery and stuff, it's pretty hard to duck.
Yeah, and it's, I would imagine, a pretty helpless feeling. What do you do in those moments? What goes through your mind?
Well, you try to know where everybody is. You have your own trench line on the outpost. It's circular on top. You have all your communications, and you have your trench line, which is about shoulder deep, and you had little called spider holes. As you go along the trench line, you had little places where you could hide and look and see where they were. No smoking, because they could see those cigarettes. It'd get you good. And when they did attack, you had to be ready. And the Marines were very organized. They were always ready. Took a few days to get Outpost Vegas back, but we did, fortunately. And they were called the Gambling Cities, Reno, Vegas, and Carson. That was a very big battle. And we all worked well together.
But a lot of guys lost their lives, and a lot more were wounded. How long did that fight for that position take, and how many Marines lost their lives?
During that time, when we were on Vegas, it was March 26, 1953. Palm Sunday was that Sunday. This happened on a Thursday night. So we were there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Palm Sunday, and Monday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. So we had 44 killed, 19 were captured and taken to North Korean prisons, and we had only eight wounded that we could send back that were survivors. The rest were killed. It was kind of a bad day, but we did win it back, but it took 5 days to get it back with a lot of help and a lot of other Marines to replace who we lost.
Well, so many things come to mind for me here. Maybe let's start here. You mentioned those Marines who were killed, that you were only able to save a fraction of the number compared to those who were killed. How hard was that? Just knowing what your job was, to see guys who you couldn't help, who you couldn't save, who you knew their parents were getting a telegram saying they're not coming home.
Yeah, it was pretty sad, really. I was fortunate enough to treat quite a few, save a few, and of course, we lost some too. And we always felt terrible about their parents getting the word that they're not coming home. But the Marines were taught that there was Semper Fi, you know, they were going to be always faithful to each other, and no man was left behind. When things got rough, they got rougher. And we thought about that a lot, and we knew a lot of the guys, felt sorry for their parents and their loved ones, and we did what we had to do, and fortunately, we did save some, a lot. And we had the retired Korean Army guys, like were 45, 50 years old. They used to do a lot of hauling of stretchers and helping us with the wounded, taking them back to the line, which, as I said before, was like 400, 500 yards. And we were out there in the middle of no man's land, but they were right there to help us. And they saved a lot of people, as well as our helicopters and medical staff.
And when I ask you about those who died, I'm also cognizant of what you said earlier, that you would make patrols with these guys. You were right there with them. So I'm guessing there were some guys who were killed who you had gotten to know, who you had counted on, who maybe had protected you before.
That's exactly right. It's a kind of a funny thing that you bring that up, Paul, because we were on patrol one night and I had this kid in front of me who I knew rather well. I won't use any names, but we crossed a little stream, and when we were on the other side of the stream, there was a tremendous rainfall, and we were coming back after 2 or 3 hours. We came to the same place to cross where we had sandbags placed, and he was in front of me and he almost drowned. He was a short guy, but a great guy. So I just reached down and grabbed him by the collar and pulled him up. And it's kind of funny. I said, what are you trying to be, a duck floating in the water like that? Well, we did get hit later, and this big Native American guy was with me. I won't mention any names again, but he got hit from a tripwire across the path. And he mangled his foot real bad. So I just said, well, I don't have a stretcher, but I'll bet I can carry you. So I put him on my back, and sure enough, like a fireman's carry, we got back to our lines, and fortunately he didn't lose his foot. Had a lot of mangled bones, but it was always very, very happy to save somebody's life and get him going.
Of course, the reality was you couldn't save everyone, and we're going to hear about one such case when we come back. How our guest, John Smetana, had the privilege decades after the Korean War of helping one family understand what had happened to a brave Marine who paid the ultimate price for our freedom. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.